This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota. Our recent shows have featured interviews about the three finalists for the Midwest Book Awards published by the North Dakota State University Press. Today, we'll hear from Denise Lajimodir, author of Stringing Rosaries, The History, The Unforgivable, and The Healing of Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. The book tells stories of people who attended an Indian boarding school. We'll revisit her 2019 conversation with Ashley Thornburg about the boarding school experience with a hopeful look to the future.
Dr. Lajimodir, thank you for your time today.
Good afternoon.
This book, I'm just going to start by saying that this is probably the hardest book I've ever had to read for work, and I cried so many times. And I've heard about the Indian boarding school era, but it's a chapter that has been buried in American history, and one of the most tragic chapters at that. What is the Indian boarding school era?
Okay, 500 years of history
question.
In 1 minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, it started in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. And had to do with Grant's peace policy. Churches were given reservations and to start mission schools. And then Captain Richard Pratt decided to start a boarding school in Carlisle in 1879. So that was the first boarding school.
And this was in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And the motto of this school was, kill the Indian, save the man.
Yes.
And the concept behind this is that after hundreds of years of forced removal and attempted genocide, that this last attempt to deal with what they call the Indian problem was to take children away from their parents and send them to schools.
Yes, they decided that the attempted extermination or genocide of indigenous peoples on Turtle Island was becoming too expensive for the war college. And so they said it was cheaper to try to educate us. So it was either extermination or education. Mm-hmm. So he started the Carlisle boarding school.
But this is not a school the way that we think of schools now.
Yeah, no. It was, students were taken from their homes and sent there to be completely whitewashed. There was forced Christianization and, of course, forced education, turning us into white people. Students were taken away from their families, their homes, their tribe, their culture, their language. The language was literally beaten out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then outing program to send them summers to work in white homes, again, to learn to be as white as they could be, and just to kill everything in them that was indigenous or native.
Mm-hmm. This was children as young as 5.
I've seen them as young as 2 and 3 in my research.
2 and 3.
That were literally stolen from their homes.
And put on trains, put on buses, shipped who knows how far away from anybody that they ever knew. And just even the first story alone, and you use the pseudonym Josephine in this story, she talks about being 5 years old and being beaten at school, and she talks about forced labor, rampant sexual abuse. She's not able to use the words, but she says that at 5 years old, she was asked to bring wine to the priests and woke up with problems down there.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, she was being molested, so she figures that they got her drunk. And then when she started having problems in her female area, it wasn't the nuns that would bring her to the doctor, it was that priest. So it was just a way of keeping it secret and not known.
How did you first learn about this history?
My interest in boarding schools began with my parents. My father was boarding schooled. He was literally stolen in 1925 from the Turtle Mountain Reservation and sent 3 days and 3 nights on a train to Chemawa, Oregon, where he was there until 1929. So he would talk about, we relocated to Portland, and sometimes when we would drive by Salem, he would say, I went to that boarding school. Well, I was, you know, young or elementary school. I didn't pay much attention to it until when he was around 77 years old, just before he passed away. I started recording his war stories when he was in World War II, and he would say, you know, the Army was a piece of cake compared to boarding school. So I interviewed him, and then I also had a chance briefly to talk to my mom before she passed away in 1977. She was only 47 years old. She was also sent to boarding school. So their parents, my grandparents, were all also sent to boarding school. And then my great-grandparents, that was the era of the buffalo hunts and then being put on reservations. He mentioned earlier before the interview about historical trauma. My uncle, who's 95 years old, I visit with him this summer, and he said that my great-grandma was kind of mean, and she would carry a pugamagon, which is like a big stick. And I asked him, why was she mean, uncle? And he said, well, he was quiet for a while, and then he said, well, she saw the Indian Wars. So it was not that long ago. I remember her. When I was 12 years old, she was almost 100 years old. So I remember visiting with her, both my great-grandmothers. Mm-hmm. So they saw the Indian Wars. They didn't get sent to boarding school, but then they sent or were forced to send their boys, and then my grandfather sent my mom and my father to boarding school. Mm-hmm. So that's that intergenerational trauma and that historical trauma. So there's something called epigenetics. So it's in our DNA. So mm-hmm. I think if someone studied my blood, they would see that trauma within my blood just from my family, much less extrapolate that to, you know, millions of Native people that are boarding school survivors here in the U.S.
Yeah, we have this understanding that if your parents smoke, you're more likely to smoke, that if your parents were abusive, you're more likely to be abusive. We are barely scratching the surface on this concept of intergenerational trauma or historical trauma. And you mentioned epigenetics, that it actually is changing humans on a cellular level to survive the kind of abuse that was rampant to the indigenous people of this land. And you say at the end of your book that when you first heard about historical trauma and what that is, you describe it like getting punched in the gut.
Yes.
Why do you say that?
It was when I first heard the term adult children of alcoholic. Mm. That was, I sat there and said, adult, I'm an adult, I'm a child of an alcoholic. My goodness, that's me. My father became a violent alcoholic. And now I understand more about what shaped his life, the boarding school, the trauma at boarding school. Then he went from there to CCC camps, and then he went to World War II up in the Aleutians. So he's probably in PTSD all of his life, mm-hmm. or what in that time we called shell shock. So he dealt with that by becoming alcoholic. So that term was like a punch in the gut. And then I started going to meetings and so on to understand more about, you know, being raised as a child of an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So then intergenerational trauma, historical trauma, again, it was like, that's me. That describes me and my family. It just helped understand why we were raised the way we were and what happened to us. And mm-hmm. Papa would, he was beaten with the belt, and, you know, Mama, too, was made to kneel on a broomstick handle at, she went to Stevan boarding schools. So they punished us the way they were punished. So we were hit with the belt, and then we had to kneel in the corner. Didn't have to kneel on a broomstick, but Mom would just yell at us girls, get to your corners, and spent 30 minutes on our knees in the corner. They also were never hugged or loved in boarding schools. And so we were never hugged or told that we were loved. Mm-hmm. And so that's that intergenerational trauma that's passed down. Mm-hmm. So then when my two kids got to a certain age, I found I couldn't hug them or tell them I love them. And I never could figure out why. And I would go into therapy, but the therapists were white, and they didn't know anything about boarding schools. So doing my research, I started seeing mostly from Canadian history that because they did not learn parenting skills in boarding schools, they couldn't pass it on to us. Mm-hmm. So as a parent, I'm trying to break that with my kids and with my grandkids, break that cycle and hug them and love them up, and no matter how old they are and so on. So trying to break that cycle now that I'm aware of it.
Yeah, not taught parenting skills and instead taught violent behavior. You have a story in the book, and again, it's called Stringing Rosaries, The History, the Unforgivable, and the Healing of the Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. We're visiting with author and educator Dr. Denise Lajmadeer, and you're talking about learning violence and these kids that are taught to use violence. There's a story in the book of a child being held down on a bed and beaten with belts by other children at the boarding school. And if a child showed mercy and hit that other child lightly, then they had to swap places. Yes. So you're teaching them, show no mercy.
Yeah, that's my father's story. It's my healing journey, the last chapter that's in the book. He told me that story when I interviewed him just before he died in 1993. He was 77 years old. And it's called the gauntlet. It was very common throughout the boarding schools. And it was done in other, you know, Fort Taunton. The students or even the teachers would line up on either side. And you'd have to either crawl through or run through as you got hit by belts or sticks by other kids. And if you lit up, then you'd have to take their place. So it was in one place they had to crawl through, and the other boys would hit them as hard as they could.
Yeah.
So that was a common, maybe it came from Pratt, from the Army, but it was a common discipline. It was pretty horrifying. So Papa said that he still had scars from that, and he was sleep on his stomach in the infirmary for 2 weeks. And, you know, the infirmary was right there on the boarding, on the school grounds, so there was no other doctors or nurses that could ask why, what happened, or report them like there is, you know, now in mm-hmm. place. You file a 960. So he said he had scars on his back, and I never saw scars on his back. But if Papa said there were scars on his back, by God, there were scars on his back left from that beating.
And there are infirmaries at the school. There are also cemeteries, mass graves, sometimes unmarked. They didn't even bother to learn the kids' names.
Yes. Chimawa, where my father was, has over 220 graves. And a gal named Marcia Small, she took a ground-penetrating radar, and there are graves on top of graves, or there are unmarked graves there. So I go there a lot. To Chimawa and walk the cemetery and pray and offer tobacco and prayers for the for the babies that are buried there that never got to go home. And I look at the 13 or so that were buried when my dad was a student there, the 5 years that he was there. And he was a carpentry student, and I often wonder, I never had a chance to ask him, but he probably had to make the caskets for those students. Or there was one student that died. His kidneys were ruptured. He was from Browning. He was Blackfeet. So was dad one of the students in the line that had to hit that student? Did he feel he was responsible for killing that student? That's something I think about, I worry about now. But I can't ask him because he's passed on. But Pratt had a system of where he had older boys monitoring the younger boys and telling on them and so on. So, yeah.
How did you get people to open up about this?
I put something in the newspapers about that I wanted to start telling stories and start interviewing about their boarding school experiences, either good or bad. Mm-hmm. And people called me and would tell me, I've got stories that would stand your hair on end, or I want you to tell the world my story. So when I would go to their home, I would travel through Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. I wasn't able to make it to Montana to some of the people that called me. But I wanted to go where they were comfortable. So if they wanted to interview in their office or in their home or even in a restaurant, that's where I would go. Mm-hmm. So I'd give tobacco. I would bring gifts to give them, because when you ask someone for something, you always give something back. Bring water, bring food to them. And then I would also tell them that my parents went to boarding school. And being Native, I think I had more of a foot in the door. Mm-hmm. I just recently listened to some interviews that were done in 1970 by a non-Native interviewers and some students from UND. And I was a little frustrated. Like, they didn't know what they were asking or even what to ask. So I think I had a bit of an in and a comfort level with them when they, I could tell them my dad's experiences, our mamas, our my grandfathers that were also beaten at Fort Taunton, you know, with the rubber hose, and he passed out from being beaten. He had stolen a can of tomatoes because it was like a sweet fruit to the boys. They were always hungry. Everybody in this book was hungry. Everyone was hungry.
There's a lot of starvation.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you even keep moving forward on this? This book took you more than 12 years to put together. I imagine a lot of that is just, I don't know, crying?
Yes, I think out of the 16, well, I've actually done close to 25 interviews. Not everyone made it into the book just due to the space and so on. Mm-hmm. So maybe someone mentioned volume 2. I don't know if I can go through a volume 2, but I am still interviewing. So only one of the women cried. Mm-hmm. And so I held up, but once I get into my car, I would break down often in tears, and it would take a while before I could drive back to the university or drive back to my home here in North Dakota. I do an hour and a half long presentation on this boarding school history, and I would practice it in my office for a year, and I would constantly break down. So I would not go out and do this until I could go through all of this without breaking down, without crying. The last few times I noticed that I start tearing up, and then I know that what I do is put it away, because I don't want to break down and cry in front of an audience or non-native students at a college and so on. So I just have to toughen up. But at one time I put the book away for 4 years, almost 4 years. I couldn't, I just couldn't do it. I was too close. I was too emotional. Mm-hmm. I even stopped interviewing for a while. Once one of the gentlemen I interviewed in the book, he became suicidal after I interviewed him, and he called me back, and because he had never told anybody that he had been sexually molested at the boarding school. He had never told anyone except for me. I was able to call the tribal mental health and get him in there within 45 minutes. He was seeing a therapist and a counselor. Mm-hmm. So that scared me. So now I will only interview if you are in a program of sobriety or therapy or have access to that.
Are you able to incorporate some of your traditional healing methods, whether it's dance or working with birch bark or poetry or...
Yeah, all of those help a lot. Being a dancer, jingle dress dancer, and my poetry is my therapy. But I also have our traditional tribal ceremonies, such as our rain dance, our sweat lodge, and there's other ceremonies that our moon ceremony, our woman's moon ceremony, where offers a wipe away the tears ceremony, or I'm doctored through the rain dance to continue this work, because I'm not going to put it away. I'm going to keep interviewing, even though this book is done. There's still people that are saying you should interview so and so, or someone will call me and ask to be interviewed. So I will continue. Mm-hmm. It's not about me. These elders, these people I've interviewed, have said, "Tell the world what happened to us. Mm-hmm. Tell the world." So that's what this book for me is done, is tell the world what happened to these boarding school survivors.
It's an important piece of forgiveness, and you have in your book, the last part is called healing, and the tribal elders saying, we can never be free unless we forgive. I'm not a good enough person to even think about being able to forgive something on this level.
We're told just for our own healing, we have to forgive ourselves. And, you know, there's a Truth and Reconciliation Commission up in Canada, but one of the commissioners said, you know, we need to tell the truth about what happened. The United States hasn't told the truth. This book is part of the truth-telling for the United States, but the U.S. hasn't done any truth-telling. And reconciliation, we're nowhere near that. What the commissioners have found in for Canadian healing is that I need to forgive my father. And maybe my kids have to forgive me before I realized that I wasn't hugging and loving. Families have to forgive each other. Fathers are asking forgiveness from their children once they were able to talk about it. So we have to forgive in order. You know, we're only as healthy as our secrets, so we have to tell our stories, and then we have to be able to forgive the unforgivable.
The book is called Stringing Rosaries, The History, The Unforgivable, and the Healing of Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. The book is available through NDSU Press. Dr. Lajmadeer, thank you for your time today.
Mingwich, thank you for having me here.
Ashley Thornburg in a conversation with Denise Lajmadeer, author of Stringing Rosaries, The History, The Unforgivable, and the Healing of Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. Her book and a memoir by Rebecca and Kenneth Bender and poetry volumes by Timothy Murphy are NDSU Press finalists for Midwest Book Awards. Next on Main Street, Bruce Berg.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bruce Berg spent years teaching English in Jamestown. Now retired, he writes and voices commentaries for us, and today's piece is a bittersweet take on aging and memories, titled Blow by Blow.
It's hardly a keen observation to note that members of my high school class are taking leave of the hurly-burly of this life and heading for other places. My classmates are passing on. Recently, I received a call to notify me that my grade school boxing buddy had died. Our recess bouts in the fifth and sixth grades involved two kids who were fascinated with the science of fisticuffs. Not the harshness and brutality of boxing, but the skills needed to snap a left jab, learn the transfer of weight needed to toss the right cross, and learn the balance required to throw a stunning left hook or uppercut. Winter was the best time for our boxing engagements, with heavy coats and mitts, and our rules made sense. No blows to the head or below the belt. And I know we didn't get angry. Nobody cried or tossed a fit. We jabbed and hooked and clinched and shuffled ourselves into the company of Joe Lewis and Sugar Ray and Billy Kahn and Jersey Joe and Gus Lesnovich. We knew all the names that we heard on WNAX Yankton on Friday nights, straight from the Madison Square Garden or the St. Nicholas Arena. For us, it was action on the Lincoln Elementary playground, back in the days before playgrounds were the source of, different kind of violence, when kids didn't threaten teachers, when parents didn't hover and overprotect. Our bouts ended with the recess bell, and we returned to class freshened by a good workout and respect for the punching power that landed on chests and shoulders and arms. My grade school boxing buddy is gone now, but the memory of heavy coats and gloves and left jabs and hooks and some fancy footwork on Lincoln's playground remains. And I'm sure that many teachers today would not respect the boxing sessions. Stop fighting would be the response. And would there be someone on the staff who would know the difference between fighting and boxing? Tommy Trosseth and I knew the difference, and I believe we were enriched by the knowledge. Today, so much entertainment for the young is provided by outside sources, video games, TV, movies, and organized sports. These activities have their place. But I still hearken back to a playground where two kids flailed away at each other and had such a good time doing it. So long, Tom. We may never be able to explain what we called fun, but we didn't need to, and we didn't try. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about the challenges facing Great Plains wheat farmers, and a conversation with the founder of the Native American Development Center about a major grant to support its mission. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum has signed an executive order extending the renewal date for driver's licenses and vehicle registrations that expire on or after March 1st until August 31st. In March, Burgum signed the waiver for licenses and registrations because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
This executive order simply adds an end date compared to what we had before, which was open-ended. And it means that on September 1, all North Dakota driver's license and motor vehicle registrations will need to be up to date.
The North Dakota Department of Transportation is sending letters to people who would need to renew licenses and registrations, asking them to make an appointment with DOT to have that done.
Currently, NDDOT is working to address the backlog of over 20,650 license renewals and over 48,000 motor vehicle registrations, all of which expired during the COVID emergency, and those are all covered under this executive order. But again, between those two, it's about 70,000 transactions that need to be completed in the next 10 weeks.
Burgum says for people who are worried about getting a real ID, the deadline for that has been extended until October of 2021. A Fargo school board member has been publicly censured for allegedly making false accusations against two top administrators. The board voted to censure Jennifer Benson. Benson is accusing Superintendent Rupat Gandhi and an assistant superintendent of withholding information about declining enrollment.
That was data specific to enrollment decline and attendance based on certain boundary proposals, and what that would inadvertently do then to CBE specifically. It was brought up and it was not brought to our attention.
Gandhi responded to those accusations.
First off, I absolutely know that we've never deliberately held information about enrollment numbers, which is public knowledge. To make an accusation that we deliberately withheld information that's normally public knowledge and is part of every presentation we did, you're questioning our intent.
The vote was 7-2. Benson and board member David Paulson voted against the censure. And North Dakota law enforcement agencies will be participating in a Click It or Ticket event from July 1st through August 13th. It's to encourage people to buckle up.
And it is part of our HEAT strategy, which is Highway Enforcement of Aggressive Traffic.
Lauren Bjork is the Safety Public Information Manager with the North Dakota Department of Transportation.
Basically, we're running the HEAT strategy throughout the summer to encourage people to wear their seatbelts, drive sober and distraction-free, and also follow all posted speed limits.
Bjork says the HEAT strategy has been successful in other states.
People think that there are more traffic crashes during the winter months because of the weather, but our statistics show that more people have died from motor vehicle crashes in warm weather months, like May through October, than cold weather months.
Since not buckling up is secondary enforcement, Bjork says a person has to be pulled over for another traffic violation.
Our statistics show in 2019, out of our 100 fatalities, 47% of them were not wearing their seatbelt. So it's just a reminder to wear that seatbelt every time you get in the vehicle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Farmers in the Great Plains are in the middle of cutting their wheat crops. Even as more people take more time in their kitchens and bake during the pandemic, Harvest Public Media's Seth Bodine reports some wheat farmers may need help to break even.
Jimmy Kinder is in what he calls wheat crop mode. Kinder, a fourth-generation farmer in southwest Oklahoma, mainly grows wheat and raises cattle. And like many farmers across Oklahoma and the Great Plains right now, Kinder's wheat is ready to harvest. He says things were looking good this year until Mother Nature brought a freeze in early April.
Just kind of like the tax man, although this time the weather, took approximately half of our yield away from us because the wheat had froze and it was just starting to flower and it was very susceptible to freeze at that point.
That means that while Kinder's wheat grew, the wheat heads are not producing as much grain as expected, and there's a flash drought. But that's actually good news for him.
That's excellent for wheat harvest, and we're able to get the harvest out with dry ground.
Dry conditions through the winter wheat belt may mean that harvest season will progress quickly in some southern states.
Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle were just positioned where our crop was mature enough to withstand the dry conditions and prepare us for harvest.
That's Kim Anderson. He's an agricultural marketing professor at Oklahoma State University and extension economist. As more people are baking during the pandemic, he saw wheat prices rise. But that was only a small bump. Overall, a global surplus has pushed wheat prices down.
The world is producing 28.2 billion bushels of wheat. That's an all-time record. And so I think it's stocks that's got the price low.
Anderson says U.S. farmers are losing about 20 cents per bushel. He says for some farmers, especially those only growing wheat, that may not be a problem.
The one that's completely dedicated will have a much higher probability of breaking even than a part-time producer because a large part of the cost is land and machinery, and large producers can spread that cost over more acres and more bushels, thus lowering the cost per bushel of production.
Anderson says lower wheat prices won't make bread or flour any cheaper at the grocery store, but farmers like Jimmy Kinder will take a hit. He says wheat is about 40% of his income. To adapt to the change, Kinder says he's using some of his wheat to feed his cattle. He's also trying to put off any major purchases.
Really, today's wheat crop is all about trying to stay in business till things get better.
Kinder says he's always adapted to the market, but with the economic ups and downs from COVID-19, he says it's put extra pressure on him.
I work all year to produce something that's marketed in 1 month, and so I've got to make sure that a year's worth of work doesn't go in vain and get the best price possible.
In the meantime, Kinder says he's applied for federal aid through programs like the $19 billion Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Seth Bodine.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that looks into America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, a big grant invests in Native American development.
Hi, I'm Tom Brousseau, inviting you and your families to spend part of your Independence Day weekend with the Great American Folk Show. You could watch the movie Talladega Nights or listen to Oscar-nominated actor John C. Reilly sing a couple of songs and read a short story. Kenneth Pattingale from the Milk Carton Kids will be on the show with a little talk and some fancy guitar playing.
Michigan's in the rear view now.
Tom Waits was among her earlier champions, acclaimed singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel.
Do you still sing about girls from last year? Do you still sing about girls, girls, girls?
Plus, rising folk Americana artist Letitia Van Zandt.
Just below the surface is a song.
And Andrea Baumgartner of the beloved Fargo eatery Burn Bombs on matzo ball soup and notes from the Badlands from our announcer Joe Wiegand. Listen the day after the fireworks, Sunday, July 5th at 5 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Mountain, The Great American Folk Show on Prairie Public. I sure hope you'll join us.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. The mission of the Native American Development Center in Bismarck is to help people thrive. Lorraine Davis is the founder and executive director, and today she talks about a big grant from the Northwest Area Foundation with our Bill Thomas. The $200,000 grant will be used to study needs to improve infrastructure, develop the Native workforce, and maintain cultural connections in Bismarck, Fargo, and Grand Forks.
One of the things that interested me when I saw that that Native Inca got this grant, and then I expected to see it was going to be on the reservations, but it's in the cities. It's Fargo, Bismarck, and Grand Forks. And that's different in a way, but I guess a lot of indigenous people in those cities, right?
Yeah, right. And you know, being somebody, you know, being a tribal member myself, you know, I moved from the Sistan-Wahpeton Sioux tribe. You know, it's just an hour south of Fargo. But I moved here to Bismarck, and, you know, there were so many challenges that I had. There's no sense of a place to go to, like what we're used to seeing in the bigger metropolitan areas across the country. There are actually Indian centers. And I know that the federal government had funded Indian centers in these bigger metropolitan areas. Los Angeles, Chicago, Minneapolis. There's many more, but those are just some of the ones that I've been to myself. But you know, knowing that growing up, going to powwows, you know, outside of North Dakota powwows, growing up in my youth, you know, I've been around and I have family over in Los Angeles, for example. And I actually went there, you know, in my mid 20s, after, you know, leaving there as a youth. I went there and really didn't know how to navigate after being gone for so many years. Of course, I had family there, so I had housing to help me get started. But I asked for the Indian Center, you know, and my family just knew to refer me there. They said, you know, they'll go there, they'll help you kind of navigate this larger community. That's what they're there for. They're to help you kind of get on your feet, you know, figure out employment, where the jobs are, maybe with resume building, just kind of things like that, and just really figure out the city and kind of help you meet all your needs and where to go to do that. So those are typical things that we know are around in different metropolitan areas. So when I came here, that is exactly what I had done, was looked in the Yellow Pages for an Indian Center, American Indian Center, Native American Center, something having to do with the different types of names of what we're called. It even went under tribal, and, you know, there was only the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. This was back in 2001. And, you know, I actually called it because there was nothing else available. So I called it, see what they could offer, what they could, any tips, anything. And they really did. And of course, they're a state agency division and could not help any at a service level. So that is a personal experience just right here in Bismarck that I had experience in needing some supportive services. So that was kind of a hindsight perspective that I can share today as to why I pursued this. But that's only one reason. There's been multiple other scenarios along the way that have led me to start this up here in the Bismarck metro area.
So you got this grant from the Northwest Area Foundation, and I'm talking to Lorraine Davis, who's the director at the Native American Development Center, and also with this new organization, Native Inc., that just got this grant that we're discussing. The grant said it was to, you know, look at the needs of the Native American people in Fargo and Bismarck and Grand Forks. So how are you going to do that? What's the plan?
Yeah, so we've done some preliminary work already. I have been working, you know, in community development finance and in housing development, working in, you know, these different arenas here over the last 5 years. I guess you could say I have, you know, a lot of colleagues through a national network that, you know, have their own Native organizations. And so through that network, you know, building these relationships, I have been able to obtain technical assistance. So for example, specifically relevant to this community needs assessment, I basically put the legwork together of all the players that are involved in community development, like in actual infrastructure. You know, that would probably be the place where, you know, since I've gained this knowledge and these skill sets and these relationships, I did not want to just only benefit Bismarck Native Americans. I wanted to use this this knowledge and this my career background to benefit other Native Americans in other metropolitan areas in our state as well. You know, of course, Fargo is only an hour north of my homelands. So I think of how many tribal members, you know, are in need over there. And not just our tribe, being the System Wahpeton. I'm very not much about being for one tribe, including my own. But, you know, just knowing that, you know, trying to think about others all the time and thinking about putting myself in their shoes, I wanted to share this knowledge and this skill set to benefit other Native Americans in other metropolitan areas as well.
So you're going to be doing this needs assessment. You've obviously, from things you've said so far, you've got a general idea of some of the areas of need, but this grant is to help you identify that, I guess, even more. Are you door to door, reach out through social media, have meetings? How are you going to find needs?
We do have a consultant that is on board. They have done community development projects on the reservation, conducting community engagement sessions. So, and typically what that is hosting focus groups, and we don't call them focus groups. We associate them with what we would call as Wopitas. I guess that would be a reference for, the Lakota or Dakota people. But basically what Wopitas are community feeds, having large community meals accessible to everybody. Everybody welcome. Come and join us. It's a sense of family, community. When we're in urban areas, even though we're all from different tribes, we feel closer, even though we're from different tribes. We feel as if we're one tribe. We have a challenge right now in trying to deliver community engagement sessions during COVID-19. But for right now, what we're doing is we're putting a work group together because we have to get pretty savvy on how we're going to implement community engagement during this time. So we know that'll be through technology, but just really all of the pieces, preliminary planning and how, we're going to get this done. Also those leaders that are from those metro areas are going to be involved.
So you are going to end up at the end of this, you'll have a report and it's going to say, well, we've been assessing the needs and here they are. And then you're hoping to take that and build with that to the next stage. What do you see the next stage? I guess it depends what the assessment turns up, but how is that going to go?
What we do know is that Bismarck is going to pursue the project. So we have to prioritize because there's not enough resources, to pay for, when we talk about infrastructure development anyhow. If it comes out that the community needs assessment for Bismarck metropolitan area, for example, says we need, a housing project, whether that be for youth or whether it be for families or seniors, what have you there, or cultural community center, or, we need a place for, like a incubator for businesses, Native owned businesses. There's a lot of talented Native artists. In all kinds of ways. I mean, not just the art type of, we have singers and dancers and performers and, all of this different variety. And, there's such a need for, for a lot of different things. So, we would definitely be first starting with Bismarck. So we would be acting upon, the results of the Bismarck metropolitan area and actually building infrastructure and, human service needs or programmatic needs. But we would keep the information for the other metropolitan areas as our next project, next in line.
I was wondering, do you know, I guess I could look this up, but what is the population of Native Americans in like Bismarck and Fargo and Grand Forks? Is Bismarck got the most, or do you have a sense of how they lay out in the different cities?
Yeah, I do. Of course, writing grants, we always have to take a look at that. And so I have, and Bismarck, metropolitan area has the largest, it's twice the size of Fargo. Fargo's the second.
So you're hoping to build on this project and have, future projects in Bismarck. And then you see eventually Fargo and Grand Forks too, is your hope?
We are, like I mentioned earlier, we are involving key leaders in those communities, now at this early stage. We want to see them because they're the ones involved in those communities, right? They're the ones that really have that purview, and those connections, and, work with, kind of, you know, work amongst, you know, different agencies and organizations already in those communities. So we want them to be the lead, the voice, kind of the host when we go there to, you know, and also they're the mobilizers, right? To get the participants, to get the tribal constituents to attend, to be even be aware that we're coming and we're hosting these community engagement sessions. They're going to be the ones that get people to show up, right? So, because they're connected and those are their communities. What we want to do is really bring our skill set. You know, we've been doing this for a long time. We've been, you know, as I mentioned again, like knowing how to get it done is very important. So this has been a vision. This is what I've, intentionally built my skill set towards. You know, my first background, you know, first and foremost, I always say is my lived experience, you know, in knowing how to design, in knowing the need. So that's the programmatic need, but then there's also that infrastructure need. And then just, you know, my career along the way, it's been housing, it's been family housing, it's been affordable housing. It's been supportive services at United Tribes Technical College, and actually the affordable housing, process, how to manage them, how to, you know, how to get them funded. So that whole development piece. And then it went on, you know, to, you know, health and human services, working at Indian Health Service at Fort Yates, hospital, when I moved beyond, United Tribes. And, you know, the vision, really this aspiration to start something and meet this need here, just, you know, the homeless thing was always, to me, it's like, we'll never achieve good health. We'll never achieve preventing suicide and addiction and hopelessness, right? All of these other social ills are results of poverty, right? And then poverty is what leads to the homelessness. And so I feel like there's just this big gap. You know, nationally, 78% of Native Americans live off the reservation, right? So, and then I feel like then we're not in this space. And so what happens is we never obtain our culture. Like we live away from our homelands for all different kinds of reasons, right? Some people are moving away because there's not enough jobs and housing, or sufficient housing, you know, on the reservation. Some like myself, you know, I moved away on purpose. There was a lot of trauma. There was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of feeling of hopelessness there. There was a lot of violence, you know, that was associated with alcoholism. So I feel like it was, I needed to escape. I needed to have a better life. I needed to come. And so I chose here because there's connections here for me. I have connections through my grandmother, who is from the MHA Nation. But yeah, so that's kind of really kind of bringing in, you know, why it's so important for us to be able to obtain our culture. At the same time, we're living in two worlds. You hear that a lot. And, you know, it's hard for mainstream to understand that because they don't live in our world. They never have and never will have to, like we have to, right? So when we come from our homelands and the way that we do things, it's just the way that we are just as people and just, I mean, just social norms and things. And although we know that there are some negative things that we don't want to carry on. And that's what we want to address through our programs. However, there are some things that we need to keep. And some of those things are, you know, just the traditional ways and the ways of being with each other. We need to feel interconnected and we need to revitalize our culture. So by building this community development project, so you think of it as building a village, so to speak, right, in an urban area, then that helps us to be interconnected to each other and then to therefore, you know, sustain our culture and our way and our, you know, our ways uh-huh. of being.
Prairie Public's Director of Radio, Bill Thomas, in a discussion with Lorraine Davis, Executive Director of the Native American Development Center. Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 24th. In recent years, we've grown increasingly aware of green terms in reducing carbon footprints and improving energy efficiency, to the point where many of these environmentally friendly terms have been added to the Merriam-Webster dictionary. But progress in energy efficiency have been goals longer than that. On this date in 1953, the city of Stanley had just passed final approval for a system of mercury vapor street lighting, and within a few days had issued calls for construction bids. The cost was to be covered by levies on the property where the new lighting would be placed, although 20% of the cost would be covered by city funds. The hope was to start sometime soon after July, with installation completed by fall. Plans for the new system consisted of 29 mercury lights, with 12 along the business section on steel poles and 17 from the underpass to the school on wooden poles. It was expected that the project would give Stanley, quote, much brighter, more efficient lighting, unquote, than the old incandescent lamps. The mercury lamp was the first type of mass-produced metal vapor lighting for a general application. These lamps had a relatively long life, were fairly easy to maintain, and had a low system cost. With a nice white light, they were perhaps the perfect value then and continued to be used across the world for decades. Installing the new system was a big step for the city. And though it would be costly, it would save money in the long run, as the incandescent bulbs were less efficient and cost twice as much. The mercury lamps had already been installed in Williston, Kenmare, and Crosby, and plans were underway to put them in at Newtown as well. You won't see these lamps installed today, though. In 2005, the U.S. Energy Policy Act effectively banned the manufacture and importation of mercury vapor lighting ballasts after January 1, 2008. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
With protests bringing renewed attention to racism, people are making a point to support Black-owned businesses. Some warn, though, it's not sustainable.
If you're talking about actually addressing the material economic inequality of an entire community, it does very little to have a few Black businesses propped up with some Black consumerism.
The impact of investing in Black businesses on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that as we broadcast across North Dakota, we stream around the world from prairiepublic.org. And you can always find the show as a podcast after the broadcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, Olympic gold medalist Monique Lamoureux-Miranda and Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson will receive North Dakota's highest honor. That's the Rough Rider Award. The twins were instrumental in Team USA's women's hockey team victory in 2018. Since then, they've been running a hockey camp for girls and fighting for equal pay for female athletes. Also on Thursday, Sue Balcom drops by for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.